I have two readings to share with you this morning. And the first, I hope, is very familiar to many of you. It's also in our gray hymnals, in fact, and we could have done it as a responsive reading, but I did not quite get it all in place for that to happen. So next time. It's called Wild Geese. It's by Mary Oliver. And if you know this poem by heart, you are welcome to join me quietly as I recite it for you. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. My second reading is a poem by Dilruba Ahmed. It's called Phase One. If you know this one, you can also recite it along with, but it's a little more obscure, so. For leaving the fridge open last night, I forgive you. For conjuring white curtains instead of living your life. For the seedlings that wilt now in tiny pots, I forgive you. For saying no first, but yes as an afterthought. I forgive you for hideous visions of childbirth brought on by loss of sleep, and when the baby woke repeatedly for your silent rebuke in the dark, what's your beef? I forgive your letting vines overtake the garden, for fearing your own propensity to love, for losing, again, your bag en route from San Francisco, for the equally heedless drive back on the caffeine-fueled return. I forgive you for leaving windows open in rain and soaking library books again, for putting forth only revisions of yourself with punctuation worked over instead of the disordered truth. I forgive you for singing mostly when the shower drowns your voice, for so admiring the drummer you failed to hear the drum. In forgotten tin cans may forgiveness gather, pooling in gutters, gushing from pipes, a great steady rain of olives from branches, relieved of cruelty and petty meanness. With it, a flurry of wings, 13 gray pigeons, ointment reserved for healers and prophets, I forgive you. I forgive you for feeling awkward and nervous without reason, for bearing Keats' empty vessel with such calm, you worried you had perhaps no moral center at all. For treating your mother with contempt when she deserved compassion, I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. For growing a capacity for love that is great, but matched only perhaps by your loneliness. For being unable to forgive yourself first, so you could then forgive others and at last find a way to become the love that you want in this world. The end of our poem. So it's very good to be with you here as we begin again in this new year. And I want to thank, as usual, everyone who puts this service together. It is clearly a lot of hands that make it possible for us to gather. So many thanks to all of you. A few years ago now, and I would have said it was 2 or 3, but then I did the math, and it's somehow 5. That's what happened in the pandemic to my sense of time. So 5 years ago, my family and I were in Pershing Square in downtown Los Angeles for the Women's March, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of you were there, too. There were a lot of homemade signs. They were held up by many women, by many people, and they said things like, "Women's rights are human rights. Black lives matter. Respect existence or expect resistance. Rights take might, dismantle white supremacy. I am not free while any woman is unfree, even if her shackles are very different from my own, which is a quote from Audre Lorde. We are stronger than fear, which is attributed to Malala Yousafzai. And one of them even said, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles across the desert repenting. You have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And I'm hoping it was one of you, or maybe one of the Unitarian Universalists across our region, who brought reading number 490 to the Women's March with you all those years ago. That was a couple of days, actually, after Mary Oliver's death in Florida at the age of 93. She died in 2019. And I hope if you were there, you brought your vision for justice and your willingness to mobilize and organize, your embodiment of how it is possible to find joy in the struggle to build the world that we dream about. I'm hoping it was one of you, because that sign and that time has become so important to how I want to cross over into this new year, this particular new year. I want to cross over into the new year by bringing with me what I loved most about the old year, all of the old years, not just last year, all those voices of wisdom, all the poetic voices, all the determination of those who have come before us. But I also want to put aside, let go of what I don't need from the past anymore. I need to make space for what is yet to be. I want to let go of what I don't have to do. I want to let go of who I don't need to be. And I want every New Year's threshold to do both of these things for me. I want to be surrounded by what is safe and familiar and comforting, but I also want to be challenged to imagine and build and grow. The essayist Adam Gopnik would say that any celebration that could do both of these things would be a compound festival. This is the kind of holiday that links two categories of holidays that he's observed in mainstream U.S. culture. Gopnik has written that there are two kinds of holidays that we celebrate here. There are holidays of renewal and holidays of reversal. So holidays of renewal are times when we get together and remember that all is calm and all is bright with the world. But on our holidays of reversal, we overturn the social order for one wild and escapist night. So Thanksgiving would be a holiday of renewal, and Halloween would be a holiday of reversal. Now, interestingly enough, Gopnik says that Christmas is a compound holiday because it links the renewal and familiarity and domesticity of the Christmas story, aspects of the Christmas story, with a lot of topsy-turvy elements that are taken from the Roman midwinter solstice festivals of Saturnalia and Calends. And those were times in history when people who had been enslaved were actually allowed to change places with those who oversaw their bondage for a single day each year. Gopnik writes that on Christmas morning, we also do a reversal when we put our children in charge and do things that we don't do every day, like shower them with gifts and sweets. So the tension, he writes, is between these extremes. We want our holidays to be exactly the same, but also completely different every day, every year. So it can be a little bit of a disorienting few weeks, at least in my house, between people who are carrying tradition forward and between people who are disrupting the way it's been done in the past. You might say it's even an internal conflict between the people we were, the people we are, and the people that we are becoming. So how can New Year's become a time that we honor each of these ways that we are, those nesting dolls of our past selves, while also allowing for growth and change? Is New Year's a compound festival? In these past few threshold weeks, I was able to spend some time with the work of Daniel Pink, who is a journalist who has studied and written about regret. At this time of year, regret can certainly feel like a burden, a boulder, a weight, a chain that is keeping us from building the momentum we need to become unstuck. But Pink actually argues that the power of regret is that it can move us forward by helping us identify what we really value in life. He is particularly frustrated by the celebrity concept, and it's in many of our lives as well, of having no regrets, right? A life motto that inspires a lot of people, but to him implies a lack of willingness to reflect deeply on our past actions and to accept that mistakes and missteps and missed opportunities are part of what makes us human. To emphasize his point that a life lived without regrets is not a life lived fully to the utmost, but rather a life lived without the ability to reflect on what has happened, he shares a memorable story of a U.S. soldier who went out with his buddies one night and got a tattoo with his life motto on it, a 9-letter slogan that he would see every time he held his rifle. 14 years later, however, he realized that tattoo did not represent who he was anymore, so he made the difficult decision to get it removed. This is a process that often costs much more than the initial inking and takes place over time, multiple sessions. So each time that he goes now, he has to explain again to the technician or the nurse that is assisting him that the irony of his situation is not lost on him. Does anyone want to guess what his tattoo that he's getting removed says? It says, "No regrets." It's a humorous anecdote, but it's a bit haunting. What if your regrets were tattooed on your arms? Would you have the courage to explain again and again to a kind and helpful stranger that you simply are not the person that you were then? That if you had the chance, you might do things differently, or even now that you do have the chance, would you be willing to share the story of how you are doing things differently every week, or right now, or today? By reviewing the personal stories provided in a research tool called the World Regret Survey and sharing the patterns he's found there, Pink has concluded that although we wish to avoid regret, which is very understandable, it is simply one of those hosts of negative or dark emotions, like our anger and our grief and our despair and our fear, that are a package deal with being human. So the question isn't how will you avoid your next session metaphorically with the tattoo removal team. It's how will you reflect on your regrets in ways that don't get you stuck in your mistakes in the past. What might they be telling you about how to be true to yourself and your deepest values today? I think that New Year's is a wonderful time to offer ourselves support for reflection, for honest reflection, especially if the ball drop and champagne isn't exactly your style. In my family, we usually celebrate the New York New Year's because 9 o'clock is like a much better time for us. Although my sons made me stay up and I didn't make it. They had to like poke me at midnight and so we could celebrate. But this is a time of year where if you do have a trusted friend willing to spend a little bit of time with you, you could talk about your roses and thorns from the year, those times that you felt most alive and connected, and also those times when you felt most cut off from honesty or pleasure or your deepest values. You could think about what you are proud of and what you regret as a powerful tool for deepening your understanding of who you are and who you've been and who you are becoming today. And luckily, if you didn't get around to this last week, in Southern California, a new year is never far away from us. Someone found a beautiful graphic for the newsletter, I appreciate that, that showed that basically you can choose a new year like every few weeks, depending on how cosmopolitan and pluralist and multicultural you want to be. There's still time. So if you didn't cross over last Sunday night, you can pick up with the Lunar New Year celebrations that will be happening in many Asian cultures over the next few weeks. I think we're moving from the rabbit to the dragon. That should be exciting. If you're not quite ready, you can wait until the spring. The spring equinox is a time when our Persian neighbors have all sorts of beautiful traditions for marking their new year. If you're not ready then, there's a lot of harvest fall New Year's that pick up with Jewish New Year, and Ethiopian cultures also are a fall harvest New Year. So at some point, I hope it'll feel like the right time to figure out how you want to combine the familiar, the idea that we're safe enough, that all is well, with what needs to be reversed in your life or in our life together. That unknown potential of the ways that we are yet to be unchanging, because the way it is now is not the way it will always be. The poet tells us, "Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine." Every time I hear those words, they haven't changed, but I have. And actually, I was reminded today, Scott, I'm so sorry for your loss and for your beloved. A friend of mine died very suddenly many years ago when I was studying this poem. I think he was 23 maybe. And I now associate it so much with the impossibility of holding those griefs while continuing to go on. Meanwhile, the world goes on. And it offers itself to our imagination. And the wild geese are calling to you, yes, you, in that language of interdependence, which was always Oliver's true subject, that ecosystem in which justice and beauty and mercy and compassion can flourish. How good it is that we have another chance today to turn toward a new year that begins on the march, not only in the marshes, with this call to kinship with one another and with the world around us. And so as you walk into this new year of new years, I hope you'll remember the words of a teacher who told us that one moment of freedom and connection can scatter seeds in 1,000 directions. Remember how much we need one another in these times and need those around us who will tell us a different story, who will hold that compound complexity of a new year that will mix renewal with overturning what is not serving us. So my New Year's wish for you, gathering here and with our community online as well, is that in this new year, you will have new ears to hear the voice of the great caller, and that you will find rest and renewal and remember your place in the family of things. May we be the ones to make it so.